Hello and welcome to a new interview from MinMax. MinMax is a Patreon about games, friends, and getting better. My name is Ben Hansen, and today's interview subject, it feels weird to call him a subject, is Rafael Colantonio, the founder of Arkane Studios, going way back. He left Arkane in 2019 after working on games like Dishonored, Prey, but he left to form a new studio called Wolfeye Games, and they're working on a new game called Weird West, which is an immersive sim. They're aiming for it to come out in late 2021, so you can look forward to it then. It seems cool. But in this interview, we talk about his time at Arkane, what it's like to ascend from a small indie company to becoming a gigantic company that's bought by Bethesda, which is then purchased by Microsoft. We talk about that as well. We just talk about the right level of success for a game developer. Talk about his time working on LMNO with Steven Spielberg, that project, which if you want to see clips of that, you can check out Danny O'Dwyer's No Clip documentary on the history of Arkane. That is a fantastic glimpse into what that project was. If you enjoy this interview, you can always check out the playlist on MinMax's YouTube channel. We have a lot more interviews in this vein. And if you want to help support us, you can always subscribe to our YouTube channel. We'd appreciate it. You can also go to patreon.com/minmax with two N's, join the community, and at the same time, unlock the podcast version of this interview, all of our other interviews, the Deepest Dives, which is our huge community game club discussions, and a lot more benefits. So if you want to help support independent games media, you can over at patreon.com/minmax with two N's. All right, without further ado, here's Rafael Colantonio. Raf, welcome to MinMax, sir.
Oh, thank you for inviting.
Yeah, nice to have you on. Let's see, last time I think interact with you in a big way was the Prey cover story trip for Game Informer. Went down to the studio. Remember that was a good one. That was an exciting game to cover because you see that pitch and it's like, this is so fun. Like, it's maybe not for everybody, but the people this game is for, they're going to lose their freaking minds. And I remember there was a moment early on, I think it was maybe even off camera, but you're like, what I want to convey is that Prey has balls. But I can't say that on camera because it's just not cool to say. But like that feeling of just like this game is going for it. And the more we can convey that, the better off it is. Do you feel like you got that message out there enough, or just how bold of a design Prey was?
Yeah, I think probably too much. In fact, like you're right. This, I think we did a great job at selling this game to people who would naturally like this game.
Interesting.
Because they, you know, it's a very... it's very inside baseball kind of thing almost. Like if you look at it and you know what immersive sims are, you totally see it and you know that you're going to love it. But I don't think as a company, and I'm talking like between Bethesda and Arkane, I don't think we made a good job at really selling it to a bigger number of people. You know, some ones who would be more... These games, you know, they are... It's all in the detail and the amount of possibilities that you have. And you and I know what's cool about those games,
yeah.
And that you're going to experience those moments that feel like you own them. But it's so hard to convey. And I'm not saying we did a bad job in the sense of like, aha, you know, like I'm not pointing fingers at anyone. It's just hard. Those games are right. Really, really hard because it's a lot of invisible value that, you know, if you've never had Amazing Oysters, for example, it's really hard to sell that to anyone, right? I could sell Amazing Oysters to someone who's already had them. Because you know what is special about them, but otherwise people are just gonna go, oh, that's just look like a clam to me. I was like, I don't know. So I think immersive sims have got this little bit of a complex quality to communicate on.
Yeah. I mean, in retrospect, do you have any takeaways? Is it as, I don't know, naive and as simple as we should have just said, it's BioShock in space, everybody, please come down.
Well, to some degree, and some of it was the name, you know, the choice of the name was probably a mistake, obviously. But because I think it turned down the fans of the original, it also turned down the ones that did not like the original, you know, so because why would they play Prey 2 if they didn't like the original? So that was kind of a weird thing. But I don't know. Maybe we could have said Bash in Space, but it's not even that really. Yeah. It was more like System Shock, which did not have much. I mean, System Shock, again, you're talking to the same people. You're talking to the same people who already got it when they saw the videos. You know, they knew what they were going to get. It's a difficult exercise. And I think some of it is the first person perspective.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because I think first person perspective comes with the expectations that you know what you're going to get. You know, you're going to get like, oh yeah, I'm just going to shoot at things or whatever. And And if I want to shoot at things, there's probably better games than this one, you know?
Yeah. That's what's interesting about, like, you know, Weird West, your new game. It's like you're still building it as an immersive sim, but I think people that see it, they're like, immersive sim from that perspective? Does that even work? But it's like, yeah, in a way, it's a more approachable immersive sim for people, just to make it more of an isometric approach here.
Totally. I think I got an intuition that this game is going to be easier to sell than any games I've done before. It's going to be easier to communicate on because of the perspective. I think people are going to be naturally a little more open-minded about what it could be. In this perspective, it could be a Diablo. It could be more of a Divinity Original Sins, or it could be more like a Fallout. You don't quite know. Therefore, because you don't quite know, you're just going to be like, okay, so what is it then? Whereas in first person, people are just, oh yeah, I know what is this. And no, you know, you don't.
Right, you know? Right. It doesn't control exactly like Call of Duty. So how good is it really? You're just going to constantly run into that. Yeah. Every review is going to be like, the shooting could have been tighter. You know all the beats.
Yeah. So whereas here it could be a Zelda, it could be anything, right?
Right. That's interesting. So not necessarily sell more than previous titles, but just an easier one to get the message out there about. That's what you're feeling about Weird West?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the sales. I mean, that's always hard to predict. But as far as, and I'm just seeing that mostly from what I see people respond to, like, you know, we've published a few YouTube videos, and I can tell people really get it. They know what it's gonna be. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's the same people that always like my game and they're just there and they wait for the next one like that. But I do have a feeling that it's gonna be globally more marketable.
Yeah, you know,
by the nature of that view.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's go back in time a little bit to you leaving Arkane. What was the process there? What were you feeling? Why did you decide it was time to throw in the towel?
Yeah, I mean, there were probably three main reasons. I think the biggest one that is, you know, is the one that I communicated the most on back then was 18 years of doing anything is very long.
Yeah.
It's a very long time. And I think when you have a bit of an adventurous nature like I do, I felt like I could fall asleep, you know, at this point. I could, like, it was on the rails that you feel, well, I got 250 people back then, a lot of good people, and you know, relationship with Bethesda was very good. It's a very good company. So if you have an adventurous nature, there is something that pushes you, you know, out of that. And I had done the full arc of everything I wanted to experience. For that story, right? Like starting this tiny company that nobody knew, doing this super hardcore games that, you know, were critically acclaimed, but with no big money, and then failing, you know, Dark Messiah was half a failure, it was a partial failure, and then almost dying 3 or 4, 5 times, not personally, but the company.
Yeah.
To selling to a bigger company which, you know, integrated us in like a big corporate world, etc., which I never experienced before. Became an exec, you know, means like finally travel business class and all those things, right? And we grow, we have like finally we have couches, I get multiple TVs, and then, you know, all this luxury thing that then, like, big budget, big marketing, stage, all of these things, you know, I went through all these things, and including like some frustration of the corporate world,
of course, yeah, you know?
Which comes with the territory. So yeah, I just felt I had to take a break. And you know, the second thing is that I really, really was tired. Like it would be nice to take like a nice break. And I had a non-compete, so I could not really do anything for 2 years anyway.
Oh, interesting.
Other than consult. So that was kind of like forcing me into, it was scary. I mean, you know, you leave something that I see now how big Arkane is. From like what, you know, you basically leave a business card, you know, you drop them out of your wallet. It's just like, that's it. I'm not, you know, it used to be very powerful. You go somewhere and say, oh, you know, who are you, sir? And you just go, yeah, I'm CEO of Arkane. And oh yeah, this way, you know, which was weird because it did not start like this at all. It took like 18 years to get there. And then one day you say, well, you know what, all that, that's it. It's done. I'm not the CEO of Arkane anymore. You know, I won't be able to say that. And that was scary. It did require some guts, or maybe being a little crazy, you know, because people really looked at me like, why are you doing this? You know, either you're being fired or you hate the people there. Like, well, what's the problem?
Right.
And it's like, no real problem. I mean, you know, was I bummed a little bit about the Prey thing and all the name issues and all that? Yes. Yeah. You know, I was like, I you know, those were things that made me a little resentful towards the organization. But other than that, I mean, I did like Bethesda very much, and there was no true reason other than, yeah, I just, the adventure must go on, because otherwise I'm just going to stay there and never evolve. You know, that's going to be like the end of my creative life. And I did not want to feel that. I wanted to start again.
Right, right. What do you think was like the biggest good riddance moment? Like, overall, pretty happy there. Seems like a good job overall. But did you have moments once you left where it's like, oh, thank God, I don't have to deal with this anymore. This is such a relief.
Yeah, well, talking to you the way I'm doing now.
Okay, great. Well, I'm glad to drag you back to hell.
Because again, you're part of a big organization. Like, the PR is like always in your you know, behind you, breathing down your neck, making sure you say the right things. You get legals all around you. You get like policies. You got stuff that is like pretty oppressing, frankly, that I don't really want to experience again. You know, I'm a free animal, and I like that. I can start a smaller company and do whatever I want. And as long as I don't, you know, hurt or don't do anything illegal to people, then it's all good. You know, we're all like friends here, and like we all have free will and free speech. And that's, I think, is very important. And when you work in a big corporation, I assume whichever it is, some are probably worse than others, then you have to go with all those rules that sometimes are arbitrary and stupid.
Right. And from the press side, you know, people commonly talk about like, why aren't developers more open and honest? I don't know why they're not more relaxed and open in these interviews. And on your end, it's just, you have, I'd imagine, just breakdowns, talking points, talk about this, don't talk about this, pivot to this. It's just like you have like a Madden playbook rolling in your head at all times. It's like, it's tough to just be frank about, here's what it's actually like to develop this game, which is, I think, what people would like to learn on the receiving end.
Totally, totally. And I have never been one to, you know, control the message or like all these, like, you know, we're in corporate world, you're being trained to, and then it sounds like you're a politician, and there's not fun, mm-hmm. nothing fun about the interview that is happening, you know.
Right.
People like the edge, they like reality, they like failure stories, they like things that are more relatable, you know. And it's, corporate world doesn't really allow you to do that, because, oh, we never know what people could, you never know about this, like, don't hurt this, don't do that, don't, you know. And the world is already like this right now, you know, there's a lot of like, oh, make sure you don't talk about this, otherwise you're going to get canceled or whatever. So it's already kind of complicated to navigate. But then if you add the corporate layer on top of that, then you really like, just suddenly you appear like some sort of a fake.
Right.
You know, and it's like, yeah, that's it. You didn't say anything, but that was interesting.
Well, you play as a supernatural assassin, navigating Dunwall, just like going to like the basic beats over and over again. Yeah.
And even that, I mean, frankly, I got to give credit to Bethesda. I think the one-liner was you're a badass supernatural assassin in a steampunk city.
Right, you know? Right.
That's so many times that I remember now. And it's cool. It's cool. It's just badass, at least, you know.
Ooh, corporate edgy. Yeah, we got the word badass in there.
You know, but no, they were cool. They let us do, ultimately, they let us do a lot of the things that no other big publisher would have let us do.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's remarkable.
And that is remarkable. And that, for that, I'll be always grateful.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about that journey through Arcane and just kind of the rise overall. I mean, you've seen so much of the industry. You've been at every level in the industry. Not many people get to found their own studio and then leave their own studio that they founded after wild success. Like, this is maybe too simplistic of a question, but what do you think is the right level of happiness for a game developer? Where do you feel like you were the happiest in that chain?
I think when we were early on part of Bethesda, but yet not integrated.
Interesting.
So we had still our own office space. We had our own IT, our own HR, and it was every month they would cover our costs. And then as soon as you start going into the payroll system and we're going to share IT now and we're going to do this, and we, you know, now you're coming to all our holiday things that we do. And then now you feel like, okay, I'm being enrolled. know, like, and it takes a while. But and again, like they you know, Bethesda has a pretty cool culture. But imagine, you know, some other publisher, then you suddenly like transition to like becoming like some sort of like, you know, you're part of a cult that you did not start. Every company is a bit of a cult. Every company has got their own culture. And, you know, cult has a negative connotation, but it is like a culture. It's like where everybody, you know, we all like we have our own language, we have our own humor, we have our own thing. And the more you try to take a smaller company and integrate it in your company in a absorption style instead of a, hey, we own you, but you guys are still you, you know, then it becomes a problem over time. Whereas at the very beginning of that integration, it was probably the best because we had the best of both worlds. We still had our own little world and the things with the way we do the things we used to do them. So if you want a graphic card, you know, I just run to the electronic shop there and buy the graphic card because I need a new graphic card. And then I invoice it at the end. It's part of the thing, you know. And then later it became, nope, now you have to fill out this form and wait until it's been signed by this person. And,
right.
And maybe work with our partners so that you get a different graphic card. You know, it's a detail, but eventually it wears on you, you know. And then you let it go and you go, okay, well, now what next? Now you're going to share your office space, your office with another company because we can make scale economy on the IT, for example, which totally makes sense on paper. But now if we do this, it's going to change our IT policies. And all the cool things that we used to be able to do, like work from home back then, which was, you know, super novel. It's not now.
Right, right.
Then you can't anymore because no, you got to like log in with all these keys and these things and you know, and corporate policies don't allow people to work from home. And little by little, you start resenting it. You go like, well, it's not us anymore.
Do you think with like rose-colored glasses, though, you're looking back and forgetting about the level of anxiety of that era of just at any moment, anybody can drop you at any point, which you experienced, right? From multiple publishers, what? I mean, Valve, The Crossing, and, yeah.
Of course. When you are independent, yet not really commercially successful, it's a pretty tough place to be.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, you're very dependent. You're very dependent on those deals that are all horrible and they all pretty abusive deals. That is keeping you in that loop of misery. So that's why I'm saying, you know, for your question, what was the best moment? I was really thriving when we were like they had the best of both worlds. We're still us. We're doing what we wanted to do. Money was not a problem anymore, and we were serious about it. We were not like, oh, therefore we're just a bunch of kids having fun. You know, it's
right,
not that.
Right.
We're like we were doing our best job. I mean, that's when we did Dishonored. And you wish corporation would understand that this is the way. You know, this is the way to do. You take someone, they have their own identity, they have their own talent, empower them. Leave them alone. Don't like try to make them fit in your policies thing that work for you, but not for us, because the more policy, the more constraint. And it's funny how people think it's a detail. Oh, you know, what's the problem? You work with creative, you know, here are all the new policies you have to apply to them. It's like, they're not allowed to work anywhere else. They're not allowed to do this. They're not allowed to do that. They can't talk about this. And it's like, oh, look, this is not us already. You
right,
know? And,
right.
And part of the rock and roll as of an independent company is that we are real. We're real. You know, we're passionate and we do things because of that, because we're going to meet another bunch of passionate and real people. So it'd be so simple to understand, right? You think like as a business person, all I have is to understand that part. And these guys are going to do a better job for my own interest.
Yeah.
You know, what's hard to understand about that? But apparently it is. Apparently it's very, very, but I don't think it is. It's just like it's insidious. It's like a small 1 inch at a time. It's like, yeah, first it's this, then it's that, then it's that. And then like you look back, you go like, you know, I got some nice couch in here and I travel business class, but you know, who am I? You know, it's interesting. It's a very interesting phenomenon.
Yeah. And it's interesting now thinking too about being absorbed in a larger corporation with Bethesda. And now Microsoft is the even bigger fish that has eaten Bethesda. And at least from the outside, like all the messaging is from Microsoft that like, hey, we want to let these studios be their own thing. And so now they're looking at what you thought was the giant corporation Bethesda and looking at them almost as a small fish. And be like, okay, Bethesda, you keep being freaky Bethesda. We're going to let Obsidian be their own thing. Do you think a corporation like Microsoft can live up to that ideal of letting each studio remain freaky in their own style?
It's possible. I mean, they're so huge that maybe they're less concerned about micromanaging everything because it can't.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion. I might be absolutely wrong about this. But I assume the most dangerous ones are the mid-sized companies that absorb another company, because they will make all the effort to reintegrate them, etc.
Right.
Whereas like a company that is so out of scale, like they are, chances are that they are operating like I was saying, which is like, well, you guys seem to know what you're doing. Just invoices your cost every year, you know, every month. I mean, and we'll integrate your final bottom line into ours at the end of the year. You know, that you would think they might do that, but I have no certainty. I can't tell. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure there were rumors circulating for years about, like, is somebody going to buy Bethesda? Who's it going to be? What would that mean? But like when you first heard, however you heard, that Microsoft was actually acquiring them, what was your feeling? Was it a relief, like glad I got out of there? Or was there part of you that's like, oh, it would be interesting to kind of see that transition?
I think it's part of the cycle of life of anything, of a company, you know, that constant movement. We would like that. You look at a band and you think like, man, why is that band changed? They were so amazing in the 90s or something.
Right.
And it's changed because they get married and they got these things. And the same way we had our story of like starting a company, then selling it, and then, you know, becoming what we became, having this super hit. Then they had their own, and I'm talking about Bethesda had their own, and which also has an effect on Arkane. So I think it's interesting. I think things are keeping motion, and there's no way to really keep something in, you know, forever the way it's the good old time kind of thing. You know, it always moves. So I was kind of expecting it, and I'm kind of curious, you know, looking where that goes. It could be good news actually. So we'll see. I've heard, you know, I don't know if I should talk about that, but I've heard a rumor that the Netflix is doing a Dishonored show, which would be incredible.
Really?
Yeah, there's a rumor. It's been on Twitter for a while now, like a month or two or something. It's a new rumor. You know, there was a rumor like about a year or two ago, but now there's a new rumor about Netflix. And so I don't know if this is true or not, but that would be the kind of thing that would be cool. And I think that definitely would be part of those changes.
Man, that has to be a real challenge for you though, just to sit back and boot it up on day one and just watch it on Netflix compared to like, I want to get in there. Like, do you think you're capable of like sitting back and just enjoying that?
I don't know. Yes and no. I think, you know, you do something and then it doesn't really belong to you anymore in a way, you know, you do something and it becomes popular and it's part of the pop culture and people do whatever they want with it. And If you're part of it, that's cool. But sometimes it's okay as well to just like, let's see it do its thing, you know? So I don't really feel like ownership of it in that sense. You know, it'd be nice if something like this happened, it would be nice if I'm consulted or something, but it's not like I'm expecting it or that I'd be feeling, you know, hurt about it or anything.
Right. Right. Do you follow Arkane news quite a bit, or is it just like, okay. You're still interested?
Yeah, of course. I'm friends with, of course, with all of them, like with Harvey and Dinga in France and Sebastian, all that. So they look at what we're doing. I talk with them and I'm looking their news. And so of course. It's like my kid now is doing their own thing. You know, that's what I told him when I left. I remember, we were trying to keep the secret with Bethesda and we didn't want the team to know until late enough. And that was, I said, like, guys, this company has been around for 18 years. And you know what happens at 18 years? As a kid, you become an adult. And so now, you can leave your parents. So it's like, that was kind of like the message.
Yeah, it makes sense. Did you have that moment of, I don't know, this is an old reference now, like the Jerry Maguire moment of like, who's coming with me? I'm going on the indie path. Come on, who do we got? You over there? Okay, maybe not.
No, there was not, because at that time when I left, there was no other plan. You know, I was not leaving to make another company. So it was more of a, yeah, as we said earlier on, it was more like a big kind of like a big change for me. That was like almost like a necessary reset of my system.
Yeah. What was the consulting era like for you?
It was interesting. I did not consult much because I did not want to go from one grind to another. So yeah. It was a few select consulting that was actually very enjoyable because I could choose who I wanted to consult with, and I decided to consult for really cool projects, and for a variety of reasons I'm not going to tell which ones they are, but it's been fun. It's been interesting to see how other people work as well, you know, because I've been working in the same company for so long that I only know my way.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would love to know. Just founding Wolfeye Studios, then, like, what have you learned about the industry that you didn't know before? Has it been a pretty eye-opening experience for you?
Yeah, it was good. It's, you know, it was like playing New Game Plus in a sense, because we started the game from scratch, but at the same time now with all the experience, so people would open doors and because, so, you know, my fear that I had of leaving Arcane, meaning I'm nothing anymore, it was not true.
Yeah.
Of course, it was just a fear. Because the past achievements still mattered a lot and helped finding money and all that. And ultimately recruiting or getting the interest of the press, which is something that has a lot of value. When you're making a new game, a new IP, and with a company that doesn't mean anything to anyone, you know. It was interesting. It was fun. And frankly, I mean, our work methodologies are probably very similar to what I've been used to all my life. So
yeah. Did you have any? I mean, with that New Game Plus idea, did you have that moment of, okay, let's be sure to keep this aspect. I want to carry forward this aspect of studio culture. This is a nice opportunity to kind of reboot. Like, what about just, I know it's probably mainly remote now at this point, but do you have a new philosophy towards just how do you maintain a healthy studio here?
Well, I mean, the huge difference from the very beginning was the remote working. That alone has changed a lot of things. It meant we could work with whoever we wanted, wherever they are in the world. And also it meant that with the different time zones, etc., we would have to get used to the how to work through you know, video conference and Zooms and all that. Which now, of course, everybody does, so it's no big deal anymore.
Right, right.
But we also see the limits of it. Now everybody understands the limits as well. Back then, we were supposed to meet every 6 months, full team. We'd go to LA and meet and have like 3, 4 days, 5 days of working together, socializing, and which was great. And we did that. And then, of course, pandemic happened, and then everybody worked from home with a limitation. But that was the main difference in the term of like, because other than that, we still work the same way, still have the same type of humor and. Yeah.
Okay. It seems to be working out okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, nice. It's similar culture.
What have you learned about, you know, just the scale of a game you needed? When you're talking to publishers, were people trying to push you towards, okay, this needs to be either a small indie-like project, but is anybody offering the AAA style budget here?
Yeah, actually, it's a great question because it has been an issue. I think we started with having in mind we wanted to do something much smaller than what Weird West ended up to be.
Huh.
And we did not have much traction. People were, why don't you do the next Dishonored? Or why, you know.
Right.
And they were not quite understanding what we were trying to do. Initially we thought, well, we're going to make, you know, there's going to be one artist, one level designers, we're going to be like 6-7 people, that's it, done. You know, maybe one, maybe two programmers max, and then the rest is going to be Julien, myself, and, you know, we can do that. And And then for a variety of factors, including ourselves, our own selves, we started to push a little bit and make it, you know, how about like this? Oh, you know, it's too abstracted. We need more execution on this. We need better art. We need better this. We need better that. And little by little, it became actually, frankly, it's my biggest game to date. Yeah. Not because of like the art production, because the art production is still pretty succinct.
Yeah.
The full art was made with four artists, which is incredible. I mean, when you look at what it looks like, it's hard to believe that it was made by four people.
But, oh, yeah.
You know, players are not going to think about that. They, at the end of the day, they play a game and they don't know how much money is behind what part of what aspect of the game. You know, as long as they enjoy it, that's what matters. But the rest, I mean, like, you know, what allows for such a huge game at such a reasonable cost is the fact that we indeed have a pretty controlled graphic production. You know, we don't have 100 people working on the art. So suddenly your budget drops severely. But at the same time, you can still, it doesn't remove anything from the depth. In fact, if anything, it adds, because now you have more flexibility to add as many items as you want, or do as many locations as you want, etc. Not that those don't have a cost, because they need to be authored. Then, you know, there's some level designer has to worry about the scripting of that place, etc. And that's a lot of work. But yeah, the team has been very efficient, and it's been stressful. It's, you know, it's a way much, much bigger game than we thought we were going to do.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think you can take solace in that idea, especially, I mean, the immersive sim crowd, which I know you're trying to expand beyond and all that, but like, I feel like people care so much more about the possibility space than how the graphics are looking. I mean, this thing.
Absolutely. I think even as a gamer, I always do that. You know, you look, oh, that looks great, etc. And then it calibrates your expectations, and then you dive into the thing, and then it doesn't matter.
Yep.
You know, and that's why so many popular games, even back then, were, you know, Half-Life 2 was the big reference of like, wow, how do they do that? And they always did the same, like huge, crazy establishing moment, you know, establishing shot kind of thing, where like everything is so much detail, etc. And then like you go under a thing, and then like that's all like square, and like this doesn't matter anymore, right? And so in a way, you could apply that entire thing to a game where if you calibrate the expectations right, and also if you focus more on art direction than graphics, which are two different notions, then it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter how many you know, passes of shaders you have on every stones of the wall of that dungeon. It's more like the idea that you convey to the player of what is that wall, you know, and that can be conveyed in a style which costs very, very little of money if it's made with elegance and powerful art direction. And so that's where we're trying to spend our dollars. It's into a smart art direction that, and as an aside, it will also distinguish you from any other game, because if you have constraints and if you decide, well, we're not going to have any normal maps or anything like that, then suddenly you look different, which is already an edge.
Yeah, that's true. And I feel like, you know, one of the biggest testaments to what the team at Arkane put together with Dishonored and Prey and all the other work is that it kind of makes every other game look bad in a lot of ways. When you play an Arkane game and it's just a series of, you know, the game saying yes to the players. Yes, you can do this. Yes, you can do this. I mean, I just had this experience playing this new procedural narrative game called Road 96. And it's like, oh, this game seems so cool. All right, let's see. I can craft my own story. And then like within the first 15 minutes, it's just a series of no, 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 can't go this way. Can't interact with this. And so I feel like, yeah, people are more than eager for just the possibility space. I mean, even saw that with some extent, I mean, with like Breath of the Wild. I don't know if you're a fan of Breath of the Wild, but was the studio talking about it? Did you talk to your peers about it just in that immersive sim vein? Where do you think it fits?
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because, so Breath of the Wild, I like in some ways, and there are ways where I'm thinking they probably had some designers that did not understand what they were really trying to achieve. And I'm going to give you one example.
Please.
That's when actually I stopped to play the game. There is this moment, I don't know if you remember, where you need to get dressed up as a woman to get in that city.
The sand one, yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, that's cool. But then there's a wall, and the wall is climbable, It's not like if they had made a metal wall where like there's no way you climb, I'd be like, okay, that's what it is. But no, you could climb, you know, and with like by being persistent, you could go on the other side of the wall, jump down the city. And then as this happens, instead of what we would have done is we would have made it that the simulation would still keep going and like the guards are patrolling and you can go around and then like avoid everything and then reach the end of the city and talk to the leader. And the leader would be like, aha, what are you doing here? Like, okay, well, I get it. You're different. Let me give you a deal. It's not what they did. Like they put some sort of like a trigger volume. Like as you get on the other side of the wall, you teleport back out.
Oh, interesting.
With the guards kicking you in the butt, falling, you fall on the floor and you go, and that's the moment I stopped because I said like, this game had everything to be an amazing immersive sim where every player can have their own version of the story, right? Because that's the power of immersive sim. Every player has their own version of the story. And suddenly someone there did not understand that part there and did not allow me. And they had everything to make it. And so to your point, did I like Zelda Breath of the Wild? Yes, in many ways. I'm not sure about the flavor because like, and I'm not so much into that kind of flavor.
Okay.
But that part really bothered me. And I was like, no, they did not get it.
I think people watch this are going to be like, man, it's like one of the most amazing games ever made. There's one detail because you went this one path where it said no, then it's like, nah, well, dinged.
At the same time, you have to see that I'm already biased against that type of structure in general. So I was like playing it with a lot of suspicions,
right?
You know, waiting for them to trip, and I love their mechanics. Those are, you know, Nintendo games. I've always liked those amazing mechanics, and it's so polished, and it's hard to criticize them in any way.
Yeah,
frankly, but that moment was damn, I knew it.
Arcane would have done it right. Give them the next Zelda, please.
Well, and it's—I don't know if it's a matter of doing it right or not. It's a matter of it's embracing a philosophy. You know, that is painful for a lot of people. A lot of people don't understand why we do this thing. You know, why are we able to kill the good guys in our games? You know, why? You know, most games, they have a quest giver in an RPG. You know, there's a quest giver, and the quest giver is invulnerable, and it's just like some kind of like a signpost. You know, you throw grenades. In fact, you don't even have your grenades because as you went into the city, all your grenades disappear, or your control for fight has been muted. You know, so most games do that, right? And if you have your control and you start shooting at people, everybody's invulnerable, and specifically the quest givers. And we do the opposite of that. We say like, no, let's go on that. Let's ride that edge where everything is still possible, and players are going to be worried that they're going to break the game for themselves by killing the quest giver. But then, like, you kill the quest giver because it just feels fun that you don't like his face or her, and it's the end of the night. You go like, okay, I'm going to go to bed. Let me just like try something a little silly. Like, I'm going to try to kill the shopkeeper, and you try to kill the shopkeeper, and the guards come in and like they kill you, and then you try again. I'm going to kill this everybody, and you kill everybody, and then everybody are dead on the floor, and then you're like, that's cool. And then you look, you know, and you search the shopkeeper, and there's some items on the inventory, and maybe a note, maybe a diary, maybe something that feels personal. Now you're feeling as a player that you're going somewhere forbidden, and it's all about transgressing. It's all about getting away with something you were not supposed to do. That's that feeling. Like why so little amount of games let you do that, right? They more. I'll tell you why. It's because it's hard as to do. You know, because then your development bloats, and you work for the gray area. You're like, instead of like focusing on the golden path, which is what 90% of the players are gonna experience, and 90% of the players are satisfied with, you work on like this gray area for that little amount of players that really care about it. Right? Now, it doesn't mean though that the 90% don't feel it, because even if they never do anything wrong, they never kill anyone, they feel that tension. They know like, I could, but I'm not going to do it. And I don't want to break the game. That tension is actually really adding to the experience.
Oh, yeah.
But it's been a fight all my life, even with my own employees, where not all of them, of course. You know, there's some. Some get it directly. Like they come in. They came to Arcane because of that. There's no need for any explanation. They were like, oh yeah, I get that. Some did not get it at first and then converted and was like, oh yeah, I see the power of that. But there's always, you know, some people that are there and like they don't quite understand, like, why can't you kill the good guys again? Like, why is everything physics in your world? Like, isn't it getting like a pain in the ass? Like, you're going to bump into things, you're going to move things around, it's going to cost more CPU time, it's more problems potentially. It's like, yeah, but you don't understand that this is also what, you know, look at Skyrim. Like, this is also what makes those games great. It's that breakable space around it, because at the end of the day, people don't want to be, I mean, some people want to be just directed like into a super, you know, like very, very funneled experience where they just had a nice ride. But I want to believe that somehow we've had so many of those games that there's space for games that are a little more letting you, the player, experience what, you know, your version of that world.
Oh, yeah. This is a very specific thing, but when you're working on LMNO, the Spielberg project, do you feel like Spielberg got that idea, or was it he was still too high above that you never had to have that discussion with him about like the value of saying yes to the player at all times?
Yeah, so I can't really tell, because back then Arkane was, we were assigned, we gave some capacity, our company and our, you know, the great talent of some of our level designers and programmers to an artist, to Doug Church and Randy Smith. The guys who were really in direct contact with Spielberg were Randy and Doug. And I was at only one, maybe two of the meetings where Spielberg was, and one of them was on video conference. And what would happen is that they would send us, they would film all the meetings they had with him, and then they would send it to them, to us. So we would see
interesting,
what happened. And so I would see how he's thinking. And he was more into, I think he was more into the story part.
Naturally.
Than the, you know, he's a gamer. He likes games and he understands them fairly well. But I think there was limitations about, I mean, it's a different world, you know, like I think he was, the habits that you get into movies lack a lot of telegraphing and suggesting things to the players. So sometimes he would come up with situations that were a little like hard to grasp for the player. You know, it would be a great effect in a movie, because as the movie, you look at the hero, and even if you don't understand why he's doing the thing he's doing right now, then it will make sense later.
Right.
Go, oh my God, that was cool. Like, you know, he did this and that, and because now I understand why. In games, it's like almost the opposite of that, you know, that you want to happen. I mean, from a narrative point of view, that's cool, but like from a player action point of view, you never want to confuse the player with why you're doing the thing you're doing.
Yeah.
So Bobby, definitely a very, very smart, obviously, you know, there's no need to tell how smart he was, great at creating characters and details about the future of the world. And that was very interesting.
Yeah, I remember you told a story once about just exemplifying the difference between Spielberg and the developers. Was Spielberg kept coming up with what you called, I think you called them like gags, like good visual gags, but it's like, one-off gags don't work in games. Those are very expensive. We need gameplay. We need loops. Like, I think your example was like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if the player crawled into a bunch of tires and then there's an explosion and then the tires went flying. But it's like, okay, what is that? Yeah. Is that a repeatable thing? What is that?
That's the best. I can't remember if I'm the one who told you that story of someone else, because it was an interesting story for sure. And Randy Smith, which of course I love Randy and you might know him as well.
Yeah.
He was in that video that where we see him, you know, arguing. And Randy is a pretty cut dry guy. He's like, you know, he's more like, yeah, no, we don't do that. We do something else. But in that context, I mean, he was working with Spielberg, so you can't tell. He was like, I can see your point. but he did not see the point. And so it was interesting to see Randy trying to navigate the you know, I mean, of course, he's dealing with a big guy at this point, and it's hard to say no
to the tire gag.
But so, you know, yeah, those were interesting moments. But then again, you know, it doesn't. It's hard to. I think it would be hard for like a video game guy to go into the movies, and it would be difficult for a movie person to to go to video games.
Yeah.
Like this, transitioning without, you know, there's an assumption that those two industries are very comparable and cousins or something, but which might be true, but the work habits and the little tricks are so different that, you know, they don't apply that easily.
Yeah, this is a specific question, but do you know if those recordings still exist anywhere? Does Arcane have them? Does Randy have them? Like, that'd be a fascinating thing for the history books. Do you think so?
Probably, yeah.
Do you think Randy would have them?
We should ask him.
Can you ask him, please? I'd imagine you have a much better chance.
Yeah. I'll ask him. I think if not, Arcane probably has at least a few of them, you would think, because, you know, they might be on a hard drive somewhere, archived. But yeah.
Yeah, for the sake of history and just seeing how Spielberg interacts with the gaming world, there's no better case example than that footage, wherever that... It's the new Ark of the Covenant, I guess that's what I'm trying to say. If you could somehow dig it up, we'd appreciate it.
I agree. And it's going to be interesting. The world is... Like, we're documenting everything right now, right? With YouTube. So in 100 years, if the world still exists, if there's still water in California, then people will be able to see all this and
yeah.
The history this way, which is very interesting.
And hey, you're adding stuff to the world of YouTube here with the House of the Dev podcast.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. How did this come about? You're a co-host with Peter, a Russian co-host. How did the whole thing form up?
Yeah, Peter Salnikov. So he's he reached out, I think, during Prey, at the end of Prey, in fact, as Prey was released, he reached out and he sent me, he's got a band, and he sent me... a cover of the song Semi-Sacred Geometry, which is a song that I made in Prey with my audio director, Matt Pearsall.
Right.
One day we were in his studio and we had, our task was to write this music for a fictional band that was in Prey. And so we had like a funny little idea, something poppy, et cetera. So we did that song and then it was part of the game. And so... and that's cool. And so Peter liked the song and he sent us a cover, like a metal cover version. And it was great. It was great. And then we started to talk a little bit. And then I learned that he was also a developer in Russia. And then that he's also had a podcast back then and he interviewed us. It was nice. Very, very cool guy. And kept talking to him for a while. Recurringly, you know, like every year or so, like there was always something happening. And at some point, like when my own band, Weird Wolf, came together, they invited us on their Twitch and we had like 10,000 views on there. We did some small live performance. And so we kind of became friends. And then he said, hey, you know, would you want to co-host a podcast, a dev podcast with me? And I said, why not? And so I reached out to... Some of the people that I know, like Victor or Harvey or Warren Spector, Ken Levine, etc.
Yeah.
And started to do that thing.
Yeah, it's nice. Like it's always heartwarming. You know, the Harvey episode's probably your best episode. It was really fascinating just for revealing, like, hey, here's the toll that game development takes on real human beings. And it's just nice that like it's so heartwarming that you guys are still talking. Even after you're not working at the same company anymore, apparently you still aren't sick of each other, which is nearly impossible to imagine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're very close to each other. And unfortunately with the pandemic, we did not hang out as much as we usually do. But yeah, I love hanging out with him. It always goes deep very quickly when us two are in the same room. And I'm not saying deep specifically in video games. I mean, we do, of course, we start, you know, nerding out around the things talked about, but like, you know, why do we kill the quest givers in games? But also, like, you know, we both have a complex childhood, and so we both understand each other very, very well. I guess that's why we mesh so well, and that's how our histories were so similar from our passion from Underworld, and both working at EA and around the same age, and we met on, you know, we both were QA on System Shock. I mean, those are funny little things. And then eventually, you know, our path met and we worked on Dishonored together and had a blast. I mean, it was great working with him, and I'm sure he enjoyed working with me too.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it a shock then to have that split where he went to work on Dishonored 2 and Leon and you're working on Prey? Did it kind of reveal new aspects of your leadership styles and kind of the differences in style since you were in different studios there?
Yeah, I think we both wanted that. I mean, like, there was an opportunity in the sense of, you know, the Lyon office and the Austin office were starting to be so big on both sides that it was really, really difficult to make one game only. And also, I don't like to work on sequels, typically. And Harvey really, really wanted it. He thought, like, it'd be good to make next Dishonored. And also, I think we, by the end of Dishonored 1, we end up having two very strong personalities working together, and we both felt like none of us worked on Dishonored. We both felt it's the other one, you know.
Oh, weird.
And of course, it's not true. We agreed 80% of the time on everything, and then there was like 20% of the time where we're like, you know, fighting about details, and most of the time it would lead to a better result that, you know, us on our own. So, but in either way, you know, either because of some like feeling that we needed to have our own thing, or you know, there was many reasons why it made sense for us to split, and him doing Dishonored 2 and me doing Prey. And I think it was great. I think, you know, Dishonored 2 was a good game. Prey was a good game. So everybody's happy. You know, there was one more IP for Bethesda. So it worked out. But yeah, it's just hard. I think when you have opinionated creative leaders they will always work together very well and also step on each other's feet a little bit, you know?
Right.
And so we I'm so grateful I had this experience. I learned a lot with him. I'm sure he learned a lot with me. And then, you know, spot of life. So we're amazing friends. You know, it's my best friend in town.
Yeah. Knowing nothing, it seems like if you're Microsoft, it's like, do we just rebrand Arcane Lyon? It's weird to have Arcane split. And if they're developing different games at this point, would you want them to rebrand it? Do you think that makes sense from the corporate point of view of like, let's just call it something else so it makes it seem like we have more studios in our pedigree here?
I mean, ultimately, it's up to them. I think the difficulty would be, you know, it's like in those movies when when someone goes into a teleportation gate and then he comes out and now there are two of them, you know?
Which is the real one?
Which one is the real one?
Right, right.
So you get that problem with Arcane because, frankly, which one is the real one would be hard to tell. If anything, the ones in Lyon could say, hey, we're the real ones.
Of course.
Because we started there.
Right.
You know, and you guys are just a spin-off. but then I was the spin-off. So, like, and I started Arcane. So then, you know, so it would be hard to decide which Arcane is the real Arcane. So, I don't know. But it would probably make sense because I think people are confused,
right?
You know, but then again, is it true? Like, I think historically there's been some other companies which have, like, isn't it Blizzard South and Blizzard North or something?
Oh yeah. Back in the day. Yeah. Or even, I mean, what, Turtle Rock was Valve South for a little bit. Like, there's been weird distinctions like that.
Or Irrational Australia was, you know, so they were, so I don't know. I think it's okay that there are special cases, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Let people be confused. That's fine. As long as the studios are happy.
Yeah. But it's an interesting story to tell.
There we go. Yeah. You seem like the type of person that's big on counting down the number of games that you could make for the rest of your life. If it's like, okay, Weird West is going to be what, 2 to 3 years of development. Okay. That gives me this number of games probably before I can't make anymore. Are you obsessed with how many you still got in the tank?
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit. And most of all, I want to make them count. You know, sometimes people approach me and they say, hey, you know, I got this thing. Do you want to work on it? I was like, no. No, I don't. If I'm going to work on anything, it's going to be my thing.
So just a big IP.
Yeah, big. Yeah. And again, it's like, I think I'm not in a mindset of trying to look for a job or trying to make a game that, you know, is chasing a specific type of crowd or money or whatever. I'm still in the mindset of making what I want to make.
Yeah.
You know, and that is really the bottom line for me. And I think I'll do it as long as it's fun. I'll do it as long as I feel like the last thing I want to do is a Me Too game, and including a Me Too of what I've done before.
Right.
you know, it could be a Me Too Plus, which I think is what we try to do in the industry, you know, where like you kind of like inspired by some of the game and then you add your own spin and now it becomes its own thing and people recognize it as its own thing as opposed to, oh yeah, it's just a dislike, you know, like you could say Prey is kind of like a System Shock like, but is it, you know, it gets a lot of the values, it gets a lot of the moment to moment kind of emotions and style of gameplay that these games were conveying back in the 90s. But like, if you do it, you know, in 2017, then it's like, cannot be the same game. It cannot be a Me Too, right?
Right.
And so that's, you know, that's to me is more important than anything, more important than money, more important than that. And then it's, you know, it's about, I mean, the energy that and the passion that you have when you're making something, something that is unique, something that is interesting that people will talk about for decades or something, like, luckily enough, a fair amount of my games, is not, you need to really pour a lot of yourself in that. It costs you something. It's not just like, oh yeah, I'm just going to do that. You know, it's going to cost you years of your life. It's going to, so the satisfaction that you get out of it, it's better be worth it. And the question I have is, you know, it's not a question. It's more like a pact that I have with myself is that I'll keep doing that as long as there is something for me at the end. Like that I feel good about it, that it was not just for money, that it was not just because I didn't know what else to do, you know, because I'm not chasing that. I want to do things that are meaningful, adding something to the game space, and that I'm proud of, that I'm happy I worked on.
And what do you think Weird West is adding? Is it just kind of a mission statement of, I can do this independently, damn it, look at this?
No, I don't think how much of it was like, I don't think it was a statement of anything. It's more like, you know, I'm an independent wolf and that's how I operate more than, it's not like my statement, it's more like that's what makes me feel alive, you know, is to have that freedom to do things. And I think Weird West, I mean, it would be, I don't want to jinx it because, you know, we don't know what can happen, but I've got a very, very good feeling about it. I think it's going to be, I think people are going to receive it well, at least the people that are in the kind of games that we've worked on before. And it's definitely an honest game that is very our passion and that is not trying to lie to anyone and that, you know, if we can get the bugs out of the way, which is like what we're working on right now. And it's like, it's not the hardest part, but it's the most exhausting part, I think, for the team, because
yeah.
You bugs. And, you know, and those games, they have so much possibilities that then they have infinite amount of bugs. I mean, they you know, never ends. And to give an example of a great game, Skyrim, you know, or like the Bethesda games in general, people have always given them shit for being a little buggy. Which is unfair because, yeah, they are buggy, but also like the reason why they're buggy is because they do things that no other games can do. And while you appreciate that gray area that I was talking about, this is also the gray area. You could also call it the dangerous buggy area, right?
Right.
Which allows people to put a bucket on the face of the shopkeeper and steal everything without the shopkeeper seeing anything, right? And that's a fantastic YouTube video. Everybody likes it.
That's fun.
It's funny. It's cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's like at the limit between the bug and the logic, you know, because you go like, well, you know, it makes sense. Like the guy's like, he's got a vision cone. If I hide his vision, it's all make it, and it works. And like that, wow, simulation, you know, clap, clap. so that's what I want to say is that, I believe that we're trying to do something with the same kind of like integrity in with Weird West, and the team has been super hard at it. So like whichever happened, you know, whether it's a success or not, I won't be able to, you know, the one thing that I know is that the passion is there and the honesty of the team and is there as well, and integrity with what we've always said that we want to do and, you know, our immersive sim culture and values.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there any big jobs that you turned down that you could talk about where it's like a project revealed where you just said like, I don't want to work on Call of Duty or something like that?
Well, I mean, there's been two instances, and some of it was protected by my non-compete anyway. Mm. But they would have been willing to have me consult instead of being an employee. And yeah, it was just not interesting, because I think, you know, I'm not like super rich, and I'm well off enough that I can, you know, it's just that I don't have to worry too much about money. But at the same time, I have simple needs. It's not like I need to be in a huge house or like own a yacht or anything like that. So I'm not specifically impressed by big salaries, you know.
And that's what they're trying to court you over with.
I'd be miserable with a big salary. Like, give me 3 months I've had those worldwide creative director thing and, you know, offer, which from a huge, huge company that back then sounded like, oh, wow, I could brag about this for at least 1 week, you know. And people would be like, man, that's really cool. But like, is it really cool? I don't know. Like, suddenly I got a label now, like, you know, oh, work for that big ass company that everybody knows.
Right.
I don't think that's cool. It's, you know, it's maybe feel safe for a while and you can put some money aside. Maybe, you know, it can improve your lifestyle. But like, fundamentally, what's under all that, you know, passion for making, you know, a lot of games, not a lot, but like a small amount of games that matter. You can do that in a huge environment. You know, it needs to be, because there's too many eyes, too many things, too many moving pieces, too many noise, too much noise. So
yeah, that's where it helps to have that experience of like, you know, you sold your company once, probably made a lot of money off of it, and realized that like, yeah, money maybe not as great as the world thinks it is for just your personal level of happiness, right?
Yeah. And yeah, all I wanted was to have enough that it's not like a something that prevents me from being at peace at the end of the month, you know?
Right.
And I think, I mean, this is a different conversation, but I wish the world was operating like this instead of like trying to go for high score. You know, I see some like super, super obvious rich people that they're just like, they're playing a different game now. They're toying with the world and tweeting to 60 million people bullshit so that it's just to see what their impact on the world, like they're playing a simulation. And you know, that's a facet of the world that I hate, frankly.
Right. Right. Well, I pray that Weird West isn't so successful that you become the next Elon Musk. I guess that's the greatest thing I could hope for you, paradoxically. I don't know.
I don't want to become a monster.
Okay. All right. So play Weird West if you're into that type of thing, and it's good when it comes out, but don't turn Raph into a monster is the takeaway.
Yeah. Don't buy too many units, please.
All right. Cool. Good message to go out on, dude. Let's see. Do you have anything else you want to plug? Where should people go if they want to follow the development of Weird West or what you're up to?
Well, I mean, yeah, Wolf Eye is, we have a Twitter. We have an Instagram, and then my band, Weird Wolves. We do some of the music for the game.
Oh, interesting.
Yep. And we also have weirdwolves.com, and you'll find all the links there, like Spotify and everything. And we play in Austin. If anyone is in Austin, we play in Austin on the 27th at the Elysium. That's it.
Is it a best case scenario or worst case scenario if somebody comes and talks to you after the show and it's like, by the way, pray rule, dude, like, or do you like to keep that world separate?
No, it has happened, and I think it's fun. I think we're in an era where all your worlds collide. You know, if you have like several personas, like you have your artist thing, your corporate thing, or maybe you're doing some other things that are even more edgy, like who knows, maybe you're a model somewhere, you know. Or trying to do acting or whatever, what is it that you're doing, you know, then everything collides with internet. There's no way you can like separate your personas very well. So at some point, I think you have to embrace it. You just have to accept that, you know, yeah, you have multiple facets and it's okay.
Yeah, for sure. Well, hey, thanks for taking the time and best of luck to the team for finishing off Weird West. Looking forward to checking out when it comes out.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting. So, you know, thanks for inviting, and I've had a blast.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you so much for watching or listening to this interview. If you enjoyed it, you can always subscribe to this YouTube channel or support us over on Patreon to unlock the podcast version of all previous interviews, all future interviews, and a whole lot more. Thanks so much, everybody. Bye.